After 3 days of intense debate at a conference in St. Louis last week, United Methodist Church delegates from around the world took a vote on the church's longstanding ban on ordaining LGBT clergy and on same-sex couples getting married in Methodist churches. It was a close vote, one that exposed a deep rift in the church that Methodists are now wrestling with. Some prominent Methodist clergy here in Kansas City are going to share their feelings about that today. First, let's get a better understanding of what actually happened. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. In the interest of full disclosure for our listeners, you should know that in my work when I'm not at KCUR, I am a Presbyterian minister who happens to lead an organization that did work in our own denomination to allow LGBT clergy and same-sex marriage, which the PCUSA did a few years ago. I wasn't originally scheduled to host today's show, but for a variety of reasons, here I am. We will, as always, be fair and transparent on this complicated subject, but we thought you should know that. So I'm joined by Mark Holland, who is the former mayor of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County and KCK, and he's also a Methodist minister. He was campaigning for what was called the One Church Plan that was defeated in St. Louis last week. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
So just so we understand the situation going into this vote, what has been the policy in the United Methodist Church?
Well, in 1972, there was language introduced into our Book of Discipline that said homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Later on, there was language added that there could not be self-avowed practicing homosexual clergy. And then later, additional language added that there could not be unions or weddings in our churches. And every year, every 4 years for our general conference, we get together and discuss this. And it has been a growing rift in the church. In 2016, the church was ready to split. And we asked the bishops to lead and to provide a way forward. And they formed a commission. And the commission worked for 2 years. They called the special session of the general conference to vote on what was called the One Church Plan, which was the plan that the bishops had recommended, which would allow churches based on local churches to decide if they wanted to host weddings and same-gender weddings and to allow annual conferences, regional bodies, to decide whether or not they would ordain gay clergy.
Now, this is pretty unusual to have a special meeting of the general conference like this.
It's the first time since the unification of our denomination in 1968 that we've had a special session. It's the first time in the history of our church we've had a special session related to a social issue.
And so what was your position on this policy sort of all along? What were you saying and doing as a member of the clergy about it?
Well, I've been an advocate for LGBTQ rights for years and years, even in college in 1988, marching in a parade in Dallas to help promote awareness and inclusivity. So I've been a longtime advocate for this. And as a pastor, our church at Trinity in Kansas City, Kansas, is very open to LGBTQ persons and fully engaged in ministry. Really, it's a situation where we just see people and not an issue.
I understand you stepped away from the pulpit for the last year to campaign on this issue specifically. Talk to me about how you did that and why you would make that choice to devote your ministry to this for a year.
Well, it was part circumstantial, part opportunity. I had decided in January of last year that I was going to step down from my church after 19 years. I was feeling called to a new ministry in a new direction, wasn't sure what that was. And after stepping down as mayor last January, announced that I was going to step down from my church in May. And as that was happening, this topic of getting ready for the general conference was heating up. And so it seemed like an opportune time to use the time that I'd created by stepping away from the church for the good of the larger denomination. So it worked out. And then we founded, Reverend Annette Roberts and I co-founded Mainstream UMC, which is a campaign specifically focused on funding, staffing, and organizing a global campaign to pass the One Church Plan.
And we'll talk with Reverend Roberts as well a little bit later in the program. I'm curious, you spoke obviously with many people over the past year in a variety of roles in the church, church members, fellow clergy, bishops. What has been the temperature of our own community on this here in the Kansas City area?
Well, the Kansas City area, and I think if you look at the map, you know, the UMC was structured to follow the structure of the U.S. government when we were founded after the Revolutionary War. which seemed like a really good idea 200 and some years ago. Mm. And unfortunately, we're still acting like it. And if you look at the blue and red map of our political divide in this country, it really matches the divide in our church. And so in the metropolitan areas, the suburban areas, you see a lot of support for LGBTQI inclusion. You get into the more rural areas further south in our country, and you see less openness to that. And so it really, unfortunately, is falling along political lines in our church and in our country, something we had hoped that we could bridge with the One Church plan.
Let me bring in Jim Brandt to this conversation. Jim's a professor of historical theology at St. Paul School of Theology, which is a Methodist seminary that I should disclose I'm also an adjunct instructor at times. Jim, you're a Lutheran, but you teach at a Methodist seminary.
That's right. I've been at St. Paul for 30 years now, teaching among the Methodists. So I'm not one, but I feel like I've been in the family for a while.
Well, you certainly deal with a lot of Methodists, including Methodist seminarians. And I wonder what their response has been to this, these students who are preparing for lives of ministry.
There's enormous distress among the students. These are largely young people who are planning to dedicate their lives to ministry in the United Methodist Church, and they are very open to inclusion of LGBTQI folk. And so their future is on the line, and they're really, really struggling with what to do. And so part of our task as seminary faculty is to walk with them and help them discern and listen and help them find voices that can help provide direction.
What is the seminary's response? Does the seminary have standing to make some kind of response as one of those schools that is training future ministers?
The presidents of the United Methodist Seminaries spoke out real clearly at the General Conference, and they are very supportive of inclusion.
And so St. Paul, does anything change as a result of this vote at St. Paul School of Theology?
No, we'll continue doing the work the way we have been doing it. And again, walking with students. And we're very clear about our own openness to any students of whatever sexual orientation or denomination. So our work continues as it has been.
You know, Mark Holland, I'm curious in some ways how the trajectory that you described for how this vote came to be happening led to the result that it did. If the bishops came forward with a recommendation to have a plan that would allow for inclusion, how is it that the vote went the other way? Maybe you could describe what the plan was that you were supporting that you think would have kept the church in a better place.
Well, I would say the large issue really outside of the plan, which was to allow regional differences within the church, comes down to, you know, in 1980.
So that means a particular conference, a particular region would have been able to ordain LGBT clergy while the next one over could have decided not to.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right. And the big difference is in 1980, prior to 1980, about 5% of the delegates to General Conference, of the 860 delegates to General Conference, were from outside the United States. Today, that number is 42%. And so there's been a dramatic change in our practice of including international delegates in the voting of the General Conference. If this had been a U.S.-only vote, this would have passed 12 years ago. But because of the growing influence of the International Church, and they said very clearly, I mean, the delegates from the International Church said very clearly, we cannot be in a church that allows inclusion, even if it's not us, because the One Church plan allowed the central conferences, which what we call the churches outside the United States, it would not make any change to same-gender weddings there or to ordination outside of the U.S. It was a U.S.-only plan. But they said very clearly at the microphone General Conference that we cannot be in a church where there is inclusion anywhere. And so essentially, I think where we're going to be moving is to a U.S. expression of Methodism.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you are a local Methodist, or even if you're not, tell us about how this decision affects you. What do you think about it? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Jim Brandt.
Yeah, I think what Mark has just said corresponds to what's happened in other denominations. In the Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, they have all in the last recent years voted to accept gay and lesbian people. And the difference is those are national churches. So they don't have
a significant... They're just United States churches.
Exactly. Yeah. So they don't have a significant presence from outside the U.S. And so that dynamic is very different in the UMC.
I mean, I have to ask, it's sort of awkward to be complaining about the UMC being a global church, mm-hmm. right? I mean, isn't that something that is a sort of a hallmark of the Methodist tradition? Hasn't that been generally seen as a good thing?
I hope you didn't hear me complaining about it. I think the issue is the international... Delegates from outside the United States said they will not be a part of a U.S. church that has inclusion. The U.S. church was very willing and voted overwhelmingly. Two-thirds of the U.S. delegates voted overwhelmingly to be in a church where there were regional differences, including allowing the international churches to continue with no same-sex weddings or ordination of gay and lesbian persons. So the U.S. church has extended an invitation to a diversity that was soundly rejected by the international delegates. And so the U.S. has wanted this diversity in a way and a willingness to have a theological diversity in a way that the international delegates are not.
Jim Brandt, why, to the degree that you can speak for them, why were so many delegates from outside the United States opposed to this one church plan that would have permitted a variety of responses in different regions?
Well, I think part of it is that in some of the countries, being gay or lesbian is illegal and punishable in really severe ways. So that makes it difficult. There's a lot of pressure on there. And we know that there are gay and lesbian people everywhere, but in some contexts, it's very risky to come out. And so I think there's a lot of pressure in those countries.
Mark Holland, I guess it's clear where you stand on the issue. And I actually watched a little bit of the live stream of the conference, and I saw your speech on the floor. You were very passionate. In fact, you had a pile of motion forms in your hand, inviting other people to essentially filibuster the plan to keep it from ultimately passing. Although it did. Why the passion on this issue?
Well, it's been 20 years in the building. I mean, I've been a General Conference delegate for 20 years. And actually, our filibuster did work. They had 8 constitutional flaws in their plan. They were only able to fix one because of our filibuster. And so the plan has gone back to the Judicial Council, which will meet in April. The Judicial Council said coming in that the plan is unconstitutional. They only fixed one of the 9 things that they said they needed to fix.
So the Judicial Council is sort of like the Supreme Court.
That's right.
It can actually strike down the actions of this big General Conference.
That's right, and has before, and will strike this down. So it was successful, though. It was disappointing that we did, because the traditional plan was not just a status quo plan. It was actually to ramp up punishment. It was a goal to certify people, not that they accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, but only to certify their position on homosexuality. And then to add mandatory sentencing, which has worked so well in our federal prison system, we thought we would try it in our church. And then to actually evict people from the church who don't agree. So it's a very different the traditional plan is a mean-spirited, very aggressive way of purging the church. It's like the 1979 Southern Baptist Convention where they purged the progressives.
But for the moment, it's the church's policy that will take effect next year if it isn't struck down by the Judicial Council.
It'll take effect January of next year. It is unlikely that any of it will take effect.
Before we take a break, I want to ask you, Jim Brandt, from the conversations you've had with your Methodist colleagues, with students at the seminary, how is this affecting people spiritually? How is it affecting their lives of faith?
I think it's a crisis for a lot of people. There's a sense of being traumatized, and there's a sense of, this is my spiritual home, this is my faith community, and they're sending me a message that I can't live with. So it's a crisis for many people.
Mark, you mentioned the awaiting the answer from the Judicial Council. What's next for you and for mainstream UMC, this group that was campaigning for the One Church plan? I mean, there is another General Conference meeting next year.
Well, we're having a board meeting in 2 weeks by phone because our board is across the country, and we're going to evaluate what the next steps are for mainstream, because we're moving into a whole new phase. You know, I'm a third generation United Methodist pastor, notably under three different denominational structures, and it looks like we may be headed to a new denominational structure now, and the role for mainstream, Uniting Methodist and other organization and other groups probably is more important than ever to navigate this for the next year.
That's Mark Holland. He's executive director of Mainstream UMC and a Methodist minister here in the Kansas City area. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Glad to. Thank you.
And Jim Brandt, professor of historical theology at St. Paul School of Theology. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
When we come back, we'll hear from some other local Methodist pastors about how they're dealing with this decision personally and in their congregations. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Central Standard. We'll be right back. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We've been talking about the United Methodist Church, which voted last week to strengthen a ban on gay clergy and same-sex marriages. We just heard from a pastor who was working on the campaign to allow progressive churches to pursue these options, which was voted down, and a seminary professor. Let's hear now from two local pastors who have had some hard conversations with their congregations this past week. I'm joined by Adam Hamilton, who is founder and pastor of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection, the largest Methodist church in the world. Adam, good morning.
Brian, it's great to be with you today. Thank you.
Welcome back to KCUR. You wrote a blog post about this, and in it you said that you believe that those who were supporting the traditional plan that prevailed at the General Conference won the battle, but may have lost the church. What did you mean by that?
Well, the net effect of this is to push people out who are centrists and progressive. So in essence, what you feel if you're a part of those groups is that there's no place for me in this church anymore. And one of the strengths of United Methodism has been its broad diversity. So we're focused on following Jesus Christ and being faithful disciples, but we also, you know, have folks who are conservative, we have folks who are progressive, and a whole lot of folks who are somewhere in between. And all of those folks who are in between and the progressives have said, look, there's room for conservatives in this church. But what the traditionalists have said is, we're not really sure there's room for the rest of you in this church. And so to me, it feels as though this church that I love is now pushing out congregations like mine. And I think in the end, they did win the battle. And I think they will have lost a lot of what the church means and could be by pushing out all of the folks who can't abide by what they've passed.
What does that even mean to push out a congregation like yours? I mean, you worship 10,000 people on an average Sunday. I would think the United Methodist Church would not make it easy for a church like yours to depart from its ranks.
Well, because the traditional folks were hoping to, or were thinking that they might be leaving, they were looking to pass something that would allow a church to take its building with them at a very low price. And I was against that because I feel like, you know, part of our, in the United Methodist Church, every piece of property is owned by the annual conference. We share it in common, and then it's held in trust by the local congregation.
The regional body.
Exactly. And so I was in favor of having a higher bar to get out because I felt like that trust clause is meant to hold us together. But they've made it fairly easy to walk away with your building. And basically what we want to do, people have asked you, I don't want to leave the denomination. I want to fix it. I want to help it be right. But if that's not possible, I think there are thousands of churches and many of our bishops who are saying, let's start the next United Methodism. And we would take our buildings and we would start that next United Methodism. We don't want to be a non-denominational church. We believe there's value in the denomination and its structures, and working together, we can do more than we can alone.
Well, you certainly wouldn't be alone in having some of those thoughts among your United Methodist colleagues. Nanette Roberts is also here with us. She's the pastor of Grace United Methodist in Olathe. Nanette, welcome to you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also a co-founder of Mainstream UMC, along with Mark Holland, who we spoke with in the first segment. Nanette, what kind of conversations have you been having with your congregation this week?
The unfortunate thing is that we're from our perspective, kind of focusing on the wrong thing. We accept people however they are and however they come, and don't feel a need to label folks. And so we've spent most of the focus of our ministry, I've been at Grace for 16 years, on our mission center, which is in downtown Olathe, that serves those who are in greatest need. And so all of a sudden then we're shocked into a reality that the church has said, well, we're not sure that we want you because you all are welcoming everybody, and everybody is kind of motivated motivated to serve the least among us, but we want to segregate who can serve the least among you. And so the conversation I've been having with our church is that we're not changing. Nothing is changing for us. We will continue to be open and welcoming. What I've done as a pastor is to seek to follow the book of discipline around issues of LGBTQIA in terms of not doing same-gender weddings necessarily and certainly not having those in our church. And what I told our church Sunday is I'm done. So I'm done living in fear. I'm done not advocating for our brothers and sisters who are LGBTQIA and not being able to be married. So
you're done, meaning you'll defy the church's discipline. Yes. and perform those marriages.
Yes. And I wanted our congregation to know that right up front so they didn't feel baited and switched by me. And by the way, they weren't surprised. And so, you know, I was willing to take one step forward, which for a lot of us wasn't a far enough step. I was willing to take one step forward to try to keep us together moving in a good direction.
Right, because there was another plan being considered,
right,
that would have simply permitted,
right,
across the whole church,
right,
the LGBT ordination,
right,
and same-sex marriage. And that wasn't even brought up,
right,
finally for a vote.
And just like folks around this table, our church has done mission and ministry internationally throughout the course of our history. And want to continue to do that, but our need to not hurt people in our own community is a priority. And let me be very clear: I was in Africa in December and participated or was invited to a same gender wedding in South Africa because it's legal there. Mm. And so I don't want to just lump everyone together of our international brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we have to be clear that we're welcoming with where we are in our context.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you're a Methodist or even if you aren't and you have a reaction to the action of the church. Again, 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Cindy in Overland Park. Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Thanks for waiting. What's your comment?
Well, I have been a Methodist all my life. I've raised four children. They've been baptized, confirmed in the church. And to be honest, I am just aghast at what has happened with this vote. It goes against my core beliefs, and I've always thought the church was open to everyone. And I find that with this decision that it is no longer evolving. And if it's not evolving, it can't go any further. And so I'm going to have to resign my membership because I can't agree with this philosophy.
And Cindy, you say you will leave the Methodist Church. Will you join another church, or are you just kind of done with church?
You know, at this point, I'm kind of done with church. I'm really kind of done with church. You know, it disappoints me that I don't have a foundation, a faith foundation. But then again, the church has really disappointed me in this decision.
Cindy, I appreciate you sharing that with us. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Adam Hamilton, are you hearing a lot of that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people who feel that way. And part of what I tell them, and this is true, seminary students who are thinking maybe I don't really belong in the United Methodist Church, parishioners who are gay or lesbian or have children who are gay or lesbian, or just people who feel as Cindy did. And part of what I say to them is, if you leave, then where's your voice? And you also need to know that there are pastors like Pastor Nanette and Mark and the rest of us who are fighting for full inclusion of our gay and lesbian friends, children, transgender persons. We are, when you leave because of that, you're leaving behind a whole lot of folks who are in the good fight, and instead stay and talk and make your voice known. And that has an opportunity to be a part of changing things. So I just discourage people from leaving. What's needed is for you to stay and stay in the fray.
What if it's just too painful? Or what if a person is preparing for ministry and doesn't see a path toward ordination for them?
Yeah, well, I tell them there is a path forward for them, and that path forward will be decided in the pretty near term. So either there's a new denomination that's formed or this denomination makes some changes, but there will be a path forward for them, and it is painful. And in particular, it's painful. I've heard from a number of my members who are gay and lesbian, who one was describing how he dropped out of church as a young adult after hearing about gay and lesbian people burning in hell and how they were an abomination. And he said, I was out of church for decades. And then I came to Church of the Resurrection. I felt like I was welcomed and loved, and this was a community for me. And all of a sudden this last week, I felt like an entire denomination was saying to me that you don't fit and you are second class. And I said, that's not what the entire denomination was saying, but it felt that way. And I want you to know I love you and we love you and this is your church. And I think most of the folks I've talked to have said, we're staying. We're not going anywhere. This is our church. And as Pastor Nanette said, you know, we're not changing who we are. If anything, we are going to be even more clear that we are a church for everybody.
Nanette Roberts, why is this issue important enough to you that you would risk the discipline of the church, as you said? What is it about this issue that maybe some other point of disagreement you had, or for that matter, all of these years up until now, when the policy has also prohibited LGBT clergy?
Well, a couple of things. One is that in probably the last 6 or 7 years in my ministry, I've done 2 funerals for folks who had not yet graduated from high school. One of the issues, who died by suicide, and one of the issues, there are a lot of issues when that happens. One of the issues was that they didn't fit in terms of issues of sexuality. And I told my congregation, I don't want to do that anymore. And if we could have been a part of one of them hearing that they were welcome and they were safe in a place, I wanted to be that voice for them. The other piece is, just like your caller said, I had a family get a hold of me that said, you know, I baptized their kids in confirmation. Their daughter wants to get married. They'll call me and we'll reserve a date for the church. Their son, who has identified as gay, is not yet out of high school, falls in love. Do they call me? If they call me, am I going to have to do it in secret? If I do it in secret, does it put me at threat? Are they going to bear the responsibility of me losing my orders? And I simply said to them, no. You call me when he's ready to get married, and the church will decide if I can do it in the church, but I'm certainly going to do that wedding.
That's Nanette Roberts. She's pastor of Grace United Methodist Church in Olathe. We're also talking with Adam Hamilton, pastor of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection in Leawood and 6 other campuses around the area. Let's talk to Linda in Kansas City. Linda, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
What's your tell us your comment. How are you feeling about the vote by the United Methodist Church?
Well, I wanted to stay quiet, and the more I listen to this, the more outraged I become. I've been not only an ordained minister in the Disciples of Christ, but I've been a member of the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church. When I spent 6 years in seminary, I realized that there are a lot of contradicting scriptures that if we, this decision that is being made to say, oh, we want to follow the tradition of the Bible, there's other verses that say, do not judge. This makes me feel like at a period when people were being burned at the stake. This whole issue makes me want to write 99 theses and post it on the wall, on the door. I just think that if the church is going to survive, they have to look in a more 21st century, opposed to living in times. And my last thought,
okay,
before I forget,
quickly, Linda.
Why? The question is why? Why is this necessary? Why do people feel this is necessary to do this? Because I think it's an internal thing that we need to look inside ourselves and not outward.
I appreciate your call, Linda, very much. And Adam Hamilton, I think a lot of people are asking that why question that Linda left us with. I mean, the motivations of those who stand on the other side of this issue from you, some of them do cite scripture, as Linda suggested. What do you think is motivating this this vote that didn't go your way?
Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of people who are good-hearted people who love and care for people and want to welcome people into their churches, but they wrestle with the scriptures. I mean, we're people who say, in the Bible we hear God speak. It is our primary authority for faith and practice. And so they read these handful of scriptures and they're not sure what to do with it. There are 5 passages of scripture that speak negatively about some form of same-gender relationship. Some of the Greek words, we're not even sure what they mean. But when you read those, you come away feeling like, okay, wait, I have to decide between the Bible and loving people. And so, I mean, I know folks who have kids who are gay and lesbian, who at the same time pastors, who are at the same time more traditional on this. And what it requires is a broader view of Scripture, the ability to look at the Bible and see, how did God speak through the Bible? How does God speak through it? There's over 200 verses in the Bible that affirm slavery. We have, you know, people say, I want to go back to a biblical view of sexual ethics. Well, you're going to go back to concubines and Solomon, who had 1,000 wives and secondary wives. And I mean, there's just, we have to look at the Scripture in the light of the historical context. But I think there's many of the folks who stand on the other side who are loving, caring people, and they feel torn between their desire to love people and these particular Scriptures. And so it's really an issue of how we're reading the Bible, not whether we love and care for gay and lesbian people.
I mean, Adam, you've written about your own views on this topic and how they've actually evolved over time.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when I was a young person, I didn't see things the same way. When I first became a Christian in a little Pentecostal church, I took the Bible and thought, well, it says this in the Bible. That's how we read it. And it was really years of working through the complexities of the Scripture. And I meet very few people whose view today on same-sex marriage is what it was 20 years ago. So, you know, most of us are in the process of evolving and changing. I once had a pastor say, why don't you just preach and tell the congregation what we should believe about this? And I'm like, so you think in 30 minutes I can change everybody's minds? How long did it take you to arrive at your position? And they said, well, many years and a seminary degree. And I finally, you know, and I'm like, okay. It's a process people are involved in. And so I've wanted, and I think all of us have wanted to make room for people to be on that journey, but at the same time have come to a place ourselves where we say, this is not how we read the Bible. And these passages are more like the slavery passages than they are the love your neighbor passages.
Nanette Roberts, I guess I'm curious how this decision and how the events of the past couple of weeks have affected you personally in your faith. We heard from a couple of callers who obviously it's taken a hit. How has it affected you?
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster ride, to be just flat out honest. I came from northwestern Kansas, a very conservative family as well, and we have struggled as a family. Because I'm kind of the wild hare that moved to the big city, if you will. I love my family. I love my family in the church that are conservative, traditional. And I love my family in the church that are LGBTQ. My issue is, as Adam has said, my issue is who's getting hurt in all of this. And what I know about my own family is that they would give the shirt off their back for anyone in need and would not ask any questions. And that's true about my church as well. So when we make this a philosophical issue, that's when we draw the lines. When we just live the way Jesus asked us to live, there are no philosophical lines. We don't ask people who come in for free meals on Wednesday and Thursday night, are you gay or lesbian? Are you documented, non-documented? We just serve folks. Mm-hmm. That's who we are. That's who I want to be. And I want to just continue to live in ministry and stop talking about this and just be who Jesus called us to be.
I want to bring our other guests back into the conversation as well. Jim Brandt, who's a professor at St. Paul School of Theology, and Mark Holland, who has been working for the past year to campaign for the more inclusive plan that was not accepted by the Methodist General Conference. I guess I'm curious, as you listen to these calls from people across the church and even from other traditions. What do you think this means, Mark Holland, for the future of the Methodist Church? How much harder has it gotten? How has it affected your brand, if I can put it that way? Are you concerned about what people think when they now hear the word Methodist?
Well, I think the church has been, not really. I mean, obviously I'm embarrassed that we're still hurting LGBTQ persons, and I'm much more concerned about teen suicide than I am about the brand of the United Methodist Church. We need to be more concerned. I mean, the people are what matter, and that's where my heart grieves. Mm-hmm. The nominations come and go, but people are people, and that's who God calls us to serve. So I just think that the church has always been behind social issues. I mean, we were it took a civil war to take the slaves away from the Southern Methodist Church. It was 36 years after women got the right to vote in this country before the United Methodist Church began ordaining women. The United Methodist Church did not desegregate until 12 years after Brown versus the Board of Education. So when you look at the number of social issues the church has, as by virtue of being a conserving institution, not necessarily conservative, but conserving, the church has always been slow to respond to broader awareness in the larger culture. So I do think that this is a place that we're way behind the culture, and we are way behind where God's calling us to be.
Well, and Jim Brandt, I mean, put that in context for us. A lot of Christians would say being behind the culture is where we should be, that that the church shouldn't be led by the culture, but rather the church should be leading it. You studied movements throughout the history of the church. How does this fit in?
Well, what I'd like to lift up is the fact that we've had a number of kind of fundamentalist takeovers of church bodies. So in the 1970s, it was the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which experienced that. In the 80s, it was a Southern Baptist convention that experienced that same kind of thing. And I think the problem is not that fundamentalists are conservative, but these kind of fundamentalists are unyielding. And anyone who's not for us is against us. So there's no room for diversity of opinion, as Adam was talking about. And they draw a hard line, and that's what makes it so difficult and creates such conflict.
Let's take one more call from Kurt, calling from Johnson County. Hello, Kurt.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
You know, I'm a professing evangelical Christian. I go to a non-denominational Christian church, and what I heard you say was the Methodist Church is welcoming of gay, homosexual, lesbian, etc. You know, my church is too. That's not an exclusive thing to the Methodist Church. The difference is we believe that the Bible is the inerrant Word of God, and we believe what it says. And you know, just like Jesus met with the woman at the well, he was not above meeting with sinners, but he also told her to go and sin no more. I think you are giving in to the society's shifting winds and compromising the gospel.
Okay, Kurt, I appreciate you calling in because obviously a lot of people do feel the way Kurt feels, Adam Hamilton. How do you respond to that? He says that his church is welcoming as well.
Right. Well, a couple things I'd say, and I appreciate Kurt calling in. First, when you welcome people and then you tell them you're welcome, but unless you can change, you've got to be you're in a subordinate position. You're incompatible with Christian teaching if you want to share your life with another human being for the rest of your life. That's not exactly welcome for gay and lesbian people,
right.
Especially
there's,
if you're married.
There's welcome, and then there's
it's a sort of
feeling
second
welcome
class.
Once
yeah.
you're there.
Like
yeah.
you're welcome, but you're a sinner. Your love for your mate is sinful. But the other thing I'd say is there's a whole lot of things in the Bible that if you look at it as inerrant, I want to know why are you not continuing to practice and or affirm today? So we came to a place where we looked at slavery and said, even though Moses allowed for slavery, Paul allowed for slavery, told the slaves to be obedient to their masters, we came to a place where we said, it's in the Bible, 200 verses, but that doesn't reflect the heart and character of God. When it came to women being in leadership, and in particular preaching in the churches, we said, even though Paul said, let the women keep silent in the church or pray with their heads covered, we say today, as a sign of submission, we say today, now maybe we shouldn't do that. And I'd ask Kurt, does your wife pray with her head covered when she comes to church? Because the scripture teaches this. There's a whole host of things. Jesus said that that we're not to store up treasures for ourselves on earth. And yet I'm guessing Kurt has a pension fund. And so I'm wondering what part of the inerrant Word of God is he choosing not to follow?
We'll have to leave it there. But I am very grateful to all of our guests. This conversation is not over in the United Methodist Church. And so we will continue to follow it. Adam Hamilton is pastor of Church of the Resurrection. Nanette Roberts is pastor of Grace United Methodist Church in Olathe. Jim Brandt is a professor at St. Paul School of Theology. And Mark Holland heads up Mainstream UMC and is the former mayor of KCK. Thanks to all of you for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ryan.
Our pleasure.
When we come back, is this the worst winter ever? It sure feels like it, but we will get a definitive answer from a local meteorologist. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned. KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. It's been more than a month since that groundhog predicted an early spring. So much for that. We've gotten more snow, more ice, more single-digit temperatures. Kids are now going to be going to school in June. It all started with the coldest November on record, and it feels like it's been relentless ever since. But the question is this the worst winter ever? Joining us to talk through it is Gary Lezak, the chief meteorologist over at NBC Action News. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
It is always good to have you here. And you know the question, is this the worst winter ever?
Yeah, well, we can talk about it. I would say the answer to that would be, well, let's talk about it first.
Okay.
And then
so
we'll
it's
decide.
Not, it's not a simple question.
No, it is not. You know, if we look at some of the stats, we'll go over there's some things in that direction.
Well, let's start with the stats. Okay. I mean, how much snow have we had, and how does that compare to other years?
Well, the worst year in Kansas City's history is about 67, 68 inches in 1911-12 winter. That winter we had a very big March. In fact, in March we had 45 of that 68 inches of snow. So,
jeez.
And I think there's another one coming our way here in the next couple of weeks. So.
Well, breaking news. Yeah. And always nice to have you here to lift us up. I appreciate that. So how does ours compare then? On the grand scheme of things, have we really had that much snow?
We've had 29 inches of snow officially at KCI Airport, and it's come in 40 different days that have had snow.
That's what maybe makes it seem like so much.
Our first snow came October the 14th, and that was we had 0.2 inches of snow. It was the earliest snow Kansas City's ever had, measurable. So it was a sign of things to come.
Indeed.
And then we've had 39 more since then, so 40 total dates with snow, a total of 29 inches of snow, except for we have not had major snowstorms that were widespread in our area. Mm-hmm. The day of the Chiefs Indianapolis game on January 12th, we had about a foot on the south side of the city, 4.4 inches at KCI that day. So it wasn't widespread. Wow. A disturbance came up perfectly that went right over tailgating that day and produced 6 inches of snow during tailgating.
Well, at least there were fires and things to stay warm, right?
Right. So, but that was one of the storms. So there have, I would say there have been worse winters, but here's a stat for you.
Okay.
One thing that has never happened before, Kansas City, the warmest temperature this winter season from November 1st through February. So that's 4 months, if you want to count that.
Yeah.
So November through February, first time in our history, in Kansas City's history, that we did not hit 65 degrees one time.
So it's not just a matter of how much snow there is. It's a matter of how cold it is. And it's been pretty consistently cold.
Yeah, but it's not going to be the coldest winter ever.
It's not?
No, it's not going to be the snowiest winter ever.
Is it at least colder than usual?
It is colder than average. December, now November, as you said at the beginning in our opening, November was the coldest November in our history. December was actually 3 degrees above average.
Ugh, I don't remember that.
Okay. But the thing about December, the warmest day in December was only 58 degrees, and that's unusual. Yeah. So that goes hand in hand. This year, the warmest temperature this entire winter season has been 64 degrees on February the 3rd. So it's the first time in our history we went November through February without a 65-degree day. We average about 9 of those days every winter.
Wow.
And so that is a record. In that context, it's in that area, it's the coldest winter season ever.
So you were the MC at the Plaza Lighting back in on Thanksgiving. That was a balmy evening, but I remember that you announced we would get 26 inches of snow. Well, we've done that. Might there be more on the way?
If it would just stop right now.
Right. That was a great prediction. You meant just until March 4th.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
If it stops now, we're at 29. So my 26 inches of snow prediction is going to be valid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still see.
Or did you mean at least 26 inches of snow?
Yes. Jeff Penner went 27 inches. And we use my cycling pattern hypothesis. And by the way, I just got invited to go to the Meteorological Technology Expo, the World Weather Expo in Geneva, Switzerland, this June. And I haven't accepted yet. I just got invited yesterday to moderate and possibly speak.
Wow.
And so I think that's quite an honor.
It sounds like quite an honor, and you are certainly worthy of it. Is it because of Kansas City's incredibly harsh winters?
It's because last year we predicted Tropical Storm Gordon using my theory. And so they're publishing a paper on that.
Wow.
And I think that they just thought that was such of high interest for the world that they wanted me to be a moderator.
Wow, that's fantastic, yeah. Gary. Congratulations.
So, thanks.
So let's see if just by sheer force of your mentioning it, we could get the city there tell us about spring. When might we see it?
There's not going to be a spring this year. I'm just kidding.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding.
No, no.
On Saturday, we're going to warm up to 50 or 55 degrees during the morning, but that's ahead of a storm system. The pattern is cycling regularly. The pattern that's set up in October and November continues to cycle. We're not going to break out of this pattern. This pattern will continue right on into the summer and early next fall before the new pattern sets up. That's how my theory works, and it works. And so this spring will come. It will warm up in April. There's going to be many days in the 70s. It'll be in the 70s next month. It'll likely get up to 70 degrees or higher three or four times this month.
Wow.
So some spring days are coming. Just that overall, it's a colder pattern. So we're expecting colder than average temperatures all the way into May and likely into the summer. So the same pattern that produced the cold winter will continue this summer. Will it be a colder than average summer? I would hint at, yes, it will be. Exactly how much cooler? Just a tad. So it's going to get hot this summer.
No one will complain if the summer is a little cooler than average.
I don't think anybody's going to complain if summer starts soon.
I think you certainly won't hear any complaining here inside KCUR. I can assure you of that. So, before we get away from winter completely, you have all your fancy computer models. We see all the maps and all the radars and things that allow you to make these projections. Are there any perhaps more scientifically dubious but tried and true ways that you get a feeling about how the weather's going to go? Are there signs that you would point to that say winter is almost over or not anywhere close?
Let's go over my theory real quick.
Yes, please.
Here's what happens. The pattern sets up in October and November every year. And we can spend about an hour on that alone. The pattern is cycling, and this year's cycle length is about an order of about 7 weeks.
Okay.
So the pattern we have now will be back 7 weeks from now. So the storm we just had, will be back around April 20th. We will have—
Too late for snow.
Most likely, although the latest snow is about the 5th to 8th of May. It can snow that late, and it did a few years ago. The storm that comes back, though, around April 18th to 20th will probably produce snow, but maybe in Nebraska and Iowa, maybe we'll just have big thunderstorms here. But that's how we can predict what's going to happen in the future.
The groundhog is not, in fact, a reliable indicator.
No, the groundhog made a big mistake this year. He thought winter was over, and he's just wrong, most of the time.
Given your ability to predict weather far in advance, I'm certainly curious to know about opening day for the Kansas City Royals, which will be March 28th. We're a little more than 3 weeks out. Can you give us a prediction?
Let me see. If March 28th would be 28, about the weather pattern around February 10th or so would be returning about then. February 5th to 10th. I have to go back and look. I think we're okay. It's probably going to be a little cool.
A little cool.
I don't think it's going to snow on opening day.
Last year was a little rainy and kind of miserable out there.
This is a stormy pattern. There's going to be a storm that week, just hopefully not those 3 days.
It wouldn't be right to have you here, Gary, and not talk about your pets, talk about Sonny. How are they doing?
Well, I've got the pet telethon benefiting the Humane Society of Greater Kansas City. It's coming up Sunday, 6:30 to 9:30 on 38th The Spot. And it's a great benefit, a great cause. Sunny, the weather dog, she was adopted. Stormy and Breezy before her, they passed on. They're wonderful dogs. And they were adopted from the Humane Society of Greater Kansas City. So I think shelter dogs are fantastic. Shelters need the funding. So that's going to be a big event. But Sunny, she turns 4 years old in 3 weeks.
Well, I will look forward to seeing her at the next event where you are the MC. Gary Lezak, Chief Meteorologist at NBC Action News, thank you so much for being
here. You're welcome, and I'm going to warm things up very soon.
We will look forward to that. That is all the time we have today. If you missed our earlier conversation about how local Methodists are responding to the denomination's decision to strengthen a ban on gay clergy and same-sex marriages, you can find that online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, a conversation about mental health in your 20s. It's a time when mental illness tends to make itself known. We'll hear from a psychologist about why that is, and a local counselor who will share what colleges are doing about it. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Gina Kaufman will be back tomorrow. I'm Brian Ellison. Up to Date is next.